The global economy continues to display remarkable resilience, but many challenges still lie ahead. Inflation continues to come down. Median inflation will decline from 4% at the end of last year to 2.8% by the end of this year and 2.4% at the end of 2025. And most indicators continue to point to a soft landing. Resilient growth and
the world economic outlook, the first chapter, which is the one where we present our projections for the next 5 years, is really a collective effort.
With all that's going on in the world today, keeping up with the important trends and gathering all the individual elements required to understand where the global economy has been, where it is, and where it's going, takes a lot of economists and some, well, finesse.
So what the research department does is we are a little bit like the, you know, the conductor of the orchestra. We provide the beat, we provide a little bit of the tunes. Here are the assumptions that we are working with in terms of what might happen to oil prices, what the Federal Reserve might be doing, what some of the major central banks might be doing. And then we have the whole orchestra is playing their tunes. But at the end of the day, everything has to be harmonious and has to be in sync. My name is Pierre-Olivier Gouinchat. I'm the economic counselor and the director of the research department at the IMF. And me and my teams, we put out some of the flagship reports for the fund, the World Economic Outlook, and other products. And we also do a lot of surveillance on the global economy.
So this latest World Economic Outlook, I think, comes with a bit of a sigh of relief for those people who've been tracking all the game-changing events of the past few years. As the chief economist, are you also encouraged by what the data says about, you know, how the global economy has fared through it all? I mean, how is it that the global economy has shown such resilience given the environment?
Well, yes, we've had in our latest report, we find that the global economy has been doing relatively well. It's slow and steady growth. It's not turbocharged. We're expecting 3.2% growth for output in 24 and 25. That's about the same number as last year in 23. Mm-hmm. And this is in the context in which inflation has been coming down. So the combination of inflation coming down and we're coming closer to what some have called a soft landing and growth remaining resilient is quite a remarkable achievement, if you want. We haven't had a global recession. We haven't had stagflation. A lot of the fears that people had maybe a year and a half ago have not materialized. So we should certainly celebrate this. Now, where is that coming from? I mean, we've had a combination of supply and demand factors. So on the supply side, which is what the economy can produce, we've produced a lot more with what we had. We had an increase in labor force participation. We've had increase in productivity in some countries. We've had robust investment. And then there's the demand side. So in many parts of the world also, we've had very resilient private demand, sometimes public demand as well. And the combination of all these things has resulted in steady growth and the ability to avoid a recession. But in the context in which the energy crisis and the shocks that we've had in the last few years were fading, so inflation was able to come down.
Hmm. And so some economies are doing better than others, which is not unusual per se. But would you say that the disparities between those economies are more acute, perhaps, than during other recovery periods? The U.S., for example, is back to where it was before the pandemic, thanks to some strong productivity, as you just mentioned, some employment growth, but also some strong demand, which you've suggested that is a bit of a concern. Maybe just talk us through what the monetary policy implications are for the U.S. at this stage.
Yeah, if I can say a word about this divergence that we're seeing between the U.S. and the rest of the world, but we see also divergence is one of the themes in our report. I mean, we see more divergence between emerging market economies and advanced economies and even within emerging market economies as well. So let me say a word about that. The first thing is that when we still on the theme of the good news.
Yeah.
When we went back and we looked at how much the crisis of the last 4 years, the pandemic and the cost of living crisis, how much of an impact they've left on the economies, what we call scarring, economic scarring. Mm-hmm. And we construct these estimates by comparing where we are now compared to where we expected to be at that point in time back in January 2020, before the pandemic and the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And for most countries and regions, these scarring estimates have been revised down. In other words, there is less scarring than we thought there would be, and that's kind of a good news. There was one exception to that, which is low-income and developing countries. For that group of countries, and they are the most vulnerable, our estimates of scarring have actually gone up, and our estimates of inflation have also been revised up. So this is a group of countries that's still bearing the brunt of the crisis of the last few years. But now, with that sort of broad context, let me come back to the U.S. So the U.S. is quite remarkable because not only it's back to its pre-pandemic trend, it's actually above it. So if you were to look at the U.S. economy and I didn't tell you anything about what happened in the last 4 years, you'd have no way of knowing that such a big crisis has happened. They would have a little bit of an elevated inflation still, and there would be quite a bit of an increase in public debt. We can come to that. But overall, otherwise, you wouldn't be able to, just by looking at income per capita or growth, you wouldn't be able to pick out that there was such massive shocks that have happened. And so, yes, they've been doing very well. What we find when we unpack everything is they've benefited from these supply forces I've mentioned. One of the very important ones, productivity has been one, but one of the very important one has been increase in employment. And among the increase in employment, there's been this increase in labor force coming from foreign-born workers that has been quite important in sustaining and propelling and pushing forward the U.S. economy, not just the U.S. You find the same thing in Canada, you find it in the U.K., a number of European countries. So there's been a strong contribution of increased employment, increased labor force with a component that is foreign-born workers.
So stemming from immigration.
Absolutely. Immigration has been playing an important role in the last couple of years. But the demand side has been pushing even stronger in the case of the U.S. And so that's why, you know, in this fight between demand and supply, if you want, this tension between the two forces, demand is sort of the upper hand right now. And this is in part why we're seeing inflation pressures maybe remaining in the economy and not coming down as quickly as one would expect. The last few prints on the consumer price inflation, for instance, have been somewhat disappointing. And some of the concern there is that this is an economy that is still fairly strong on the demand side. We see tight labor markets, and our own analysis finds that this plays an important role in the inflation dynamics in the U.S. So that will have to cool off. That the labor market is still tight. That will have to cool off. Some of these demand forces will have to abate for inflation to be coming down. You look at other countries, you look at the euro area, you have no sign of demand forces being that strong. No. You have no sign of output being running above what the economy can produce, what we call potential output. There is no sign that the output gap is positive, quite the contrary. So in fact, the drivers of what's going on in the euro area and other advanced economies is quite different.
Oh, interesting. So the report also calls for fiscal consolidation pretty much everywhere, but especially in the U.S., where you've suggested that the fiscal stance is out of line with long-term fiscal sustainability there. Maybe unpack that a little bit for us. But also what I thought was interesting is that you have referred to what happened in 1993 in terms of fiscal consolidations that perhaps countries could learn from. Maybe remind us what happened back in 1993 that was so remarkable.
Yeah, so what we are seeing now is as the fight against inflation is being won, we're coming out of this very, very tumultuous period. And countries have accumulated a lot of debt. A lot of countries have accumulated a lot of debt. Why? Because governments stepped in and they tried to protect households and businesses. And they've done so relatively effectively. And so I think, that was the right response to deploy these fiscal instruments and measures. Yeah. But now we have to rebuild some of this fiscal space. We use this image of restocking the fiscal arsenal in our Rio chapter. And that's true for a lot of countries. A lot of countries have to do that. Certainly the United States has to do that. Their fiscal policy, if anything, is really still accumulating a lot of very substantial deficits, accumulating debt at a fairly high speed. So there is a need to get that under control. The reference to the 1993 episode, in my view, what I wanted to convey with this was the following. It's maybe more relevant for the European countries than it is for the U.S.
Oh, okay.
And what happened in 1993 is the Clinton administration, newly elected, came into office and wanted to implement a fiscal consolidation. There was a sense of, although the numbers may make us laugh nowadays, but there was a sense that they needed to maybe be a bit more prudent on the fiscal side. And they were concerned that if they were going to do that, the economy was still fairly weak, that could tip the economy into a recession. And it would have been great to have some support from the Federal Reserve. If the Federal Reserve could have helped by maybe cutting rates a little bit, giving a little bit more room to the economy, then there would be a nice combination of monetary policy easing at the same time as fiscal policy is tightening, and you get to the right landing place. You improve the fiscal accounts, and you don't tip the economy into a recession. And there is a sense that for many countries, if we look at European economies now, they also need to do fiscal consolidation. Their economies are weak. We're going from 0.4% to 0.8% growth projected for next year. That fiscal consolidation, if too much is done or too quickly, it's absolutely needed. But if it is done, it could slow down the economy and tip it into a recession. So there is a need for having some, response or accompanying measure from the European Central Bank in that case to make sure that we navigate that path. And it's always very difficult because monetary policy can act very quickly. You lower interest rates, you raise interest rates. It's a decision you can take on a fairly frequent basis. Fiscal policy takes time. You have to go through Congress. You have to go through national parliaments. And you are not quite sure that these bodies will deliver on what they say. A lot of things can change. And so there is a sense in which it's important to build the credibility of this fiscal adjustment. And the more credible the fiscal adjustment is, then the easier it is for monetary authorities, the central banks, to come in and help along. And in 1993, there was this little symbolic moment, which is at the State of the Union address. Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve at the time, was sitting next to Hillary Clinton, listening to the State of the Union address by the newly elected president, Bill Clinton. And this was a signal that was sent to the market, look, we're working hand in hand. Trust us, we're going to get there, and monetary policy is going to help. And I think there is something there for other countries to think about. Let's make sure we have credible fiscal policy, and then monetary policy will be able to help.
Incredible. Good story. Another concern in the WIO is medium-term prospects, which are declining with some of the lowest numbers in decades. How much of a concern is that, and what do you think could be done to turn it around?
Well, we have, we've noticed that medium-term growth has been declining. It's been declining across the board, so it's in pretty much every country or group of countries. We're seeing lower medium-term growth, and it's been happening over the last 25-plus years. But it's been happening more for the emerging market and developing economies than it has been happening for the advanced economies. Now, advanced economies grow at a slower rate, and we expect emerging market and developing economies to grow faster. That's how they are catching up. And now, if the gap between the growth rates is becoming smaller, then it will take them longer to catch up. And that's the concern here, is that the horizon at which emerging market and developing economies can be expected to close that gap is being extended into the future. And that matters because these countries also face very serious fiscal needs. Whether we're thinking about social development goals, of course, for low-income countries, but if we're thinking about the climate transition, we're thinking about all of the reshuffling that is happening when we think about increased this geopolitical and geoeconomic fragmentation. So these countries have important fiscal needs. They right now also face a situation where interest rates are higher, and they're higher around the world. So there is fiscal pressure coming from that, and that's weighing down on their economies. So this is certainly a concern. And we've done in our WEO World Economic Outlook Chapter 3, we've done an in-depth analysis of what is behind this decline in growth rates. And we find that some of it is, of course, coming from population aging. So the share of the population in the working age, if you want, is decreasing. And so that means you have fewer bodies that are able to be engaged in production or in productive activities generally. But we also have a decline in productivity. So the ability to do things efficiently, that is not increasing at the same rate as it used to in the past. And we have, in some countries, we also have a decline in overall investment. So pretty much less investment, less growth in the labor force because of population aging, and less productivity. And the one that is really jumping at us is the decline in productivity. Because that's kind of a little bit of a mystery. We don't really understand always what is happening. What do we measure with productivity? In fact, mechanically, we even measure it as a residual. It's the part that is not explained by the decline in or change in labor force and change in investment and capital accumulation. And there, what we found is that some of that decrease in productivity growth can be attributed to what we call misallocation. And so misallocation, let me give a sense of what it is exactly, because that can sound like a little bit of an abstract term. It's that in order to produce, you need to match the right workers to the right type of tasks and the right type of capital. So if you have a very high-skilled worker and you have a very advanced piece of machinery, you want your high-skilled worker to operate the most advanced piece of machinery, while instead if you have sort of relatively low-skill tools and maybe some less-skilled workers can operate those low-skill tools. So this misallocation is something that is always happening, but there's been an increase in misallocation over time in many countries. Again, the U.S. is an exception in our detailed firm level analysis. And some of that increased misallocation could reflect the fact that we are in a world in which there are more shocks. There are more, so businesses in sectors and sectors inside an economy are constantly trying to adapt, and it's becoming more difficult. They have to move the resources to the right place. The resources have to be moved to the right firms or to the right sectors. And this can be increasingly difficult to implement.
That's so interesting. So do you think that the advancements in technology is actually contributing to this misallocation?
Eventually, advancement in technology should help us to make workers more productive and make capital more productive. But in the process of reallocating resources as new technologies are introduced, you can see an increase in misallocation. And so there is a glass half full part of the story here, which is that we're measuring an increase in misallocation because maybe we're in the middle of some of these transitions that are sort of slow. Speed transitions, the introduction of communication technology, information and communication technology, the digitalization of production processes, all of these things take time. They don't happen overnight. And along the way, you could have some increased misallocation of resources, but then over time, then that misallocation could be reduced, and then that would result in a pickup in productivity in those sectors, businesses, and economies.
Mm. So emerging markets. It's interesting that when we spoke last in 2022 on this program, only months after you started as chief economist and right before the inflation took off, or it was starting to take off, you talked about the rise of emerging markets and how important that was. And so this WEO suggests that emerging market economies are in fact expanding their footprint on the global economy. How is that playing out? And why do you feel this is such an important trend for the global economy?
Well, so let me take a step back here and start from one really very strong observation that comes from the WEO this time, but also the WEOs we've been doing in the last year or so. When we talk about resilience, the resilience of emerging markets, it's quite remarkable. Mm-hmm. I mean, back in April 2022, when I just started, we were just on the eve of this massive increase in policy rates by advanced economy central banks. And it was just about to start the sequence of 75 basis points increase by the Federal Reserve, the ECB, et cetera. And if anyone at that time had asked me, the Fed is about to increase in cumulative terms by 500 basis points, the ECB by a little bit less, but around there, what do you think will happen to emerging market economies? And I would have answered with almost absolute confidence, it's going to be a bloodbath.
Wow.
And it did not happen. And the fact that it did not happen means that there is something that we can learn there.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've learned is that a lot of emerging market economies, so some of them benefited from luck. They were commodity producers. This was in the middle of really high commodity prices. But beyond that, beyond luck, there was an improvement in frameworks. So a lot of them built their monetary fiscal frameworks. They were able to respond in ways that would let their economy adapt to this really enormous change in the monetary conditions, mm-hmm. and not be suffering from sudden stops or being pulled under. And so that's a tremendous achievement. It's also something that is still with them. The tensions that we're seeing, we talked about the divergence between, say, the U.S. and the euro area, or that is something that means also that we are seeing strong dollars. We are seeing a strong dollar. That is something that is a source of concern for many of these emerging market economies. They have to navigate that. And again, their frameworks can help them do that, but it's going to be tricky going forward as well. Now, coming back to the chapter we had on the trading places, the increasing footprint of large emerging market economies, I mean, this is going to be incredibly important because we are seeing the fact that they can become really a power, an engine of growth in the global economy. I mean, China is expected to have lower growth going forward because of some of the structural problems that it faces that are not going to go away very quickly. And so we expect lower growth for China going forward. The advanced economies are growing, but they are not growing at the same turbocharge rates. And so overall, the growth rates there are sort of below historical averages as well. So having the emergence of robust, resilient, large emerging market economies that are going to be increasing their market share is going to be a positive news for the global economy.
Mm. So, with the inflation, as you mentioned, being part of the good news, subsiding, we've seen prices coming down on goods, on food, and on energy to a certain degree anyway. But oil prices are creeping up again, and the WEO attributes that to increasing geopolitical tensions. How is, all the conflict and the political turmoil that's happening right now in the world, how is that affecting the global economy?
Well, it's certainly not helping, for sure. The tensions, the most recent tensions that we've seen in the Middle East and the disruptions in shipping in the Red Sea and through the Suez Canal, and the increase in oil prices that you've mentioned, they've increased a bit since the turn of the year. That is certainly something that could weigh on global activity, global output, could push up prices of goods that are imported or produced. So that would result, again, in lower activity, more inflation, the kind of supply shock to the global economy that we have experienced in the last 4 years. Now, our estimates at this point of where we are is that this so far has had a relatively minor impact. Yes, it has increased shipping costs, and there has been some rerouting through the Cape of Good Hope, for instance, for shipping that used to go through the Red Sea, container ships that used to go through the Red Sea. And there's been some increase in oil prices. But the impact on activity and inflation so far remains modest. But it is obviously an important risk factor. It's something that we could see escalation in that space, we could see more disruptions. And that's something that we analyze in the World Economic Outlook. We run one of the scenarios. We like to run a number of scenarios to think not just about the baseline, but think about what could happen if. The what-if scenarios are really important to try to understand how different countries, regions might be affected. And that's one of the scenarios we run. And indeed, if we had a more substantial disruption in shipping costs and oil prices than we've seen so far, then there would be upward pressure on inflation, and there would be a negative impact on global activity. But more broadly, and so let me broaden a little bit from just the Middle East and the tensions we've seen. One of the things we have been very concerned at the IMF about over the last 2 years, for sure, but even before that, is what we call the rise in geoeconomic fragmentation.
Yeah.
So the increased number of trade disruptive measures. And to give you a sense of what I mean by this is we try to keep track of measures countries can implement that could have a disruptive effect on international trade. And that could go from a country putting a ban on some of the agricultural products that they produce, or there could be a country that puts some restrictions on imports coming from some other country, or it puts in place some form of industrial policy that has an impact on foreign producers and on competition. And this number of trade restrictive measures has exploded. There were around 1,000 in 2019. That was already a high watermark at the time. They've been creeping up already by 2019 and are now above 3,000. So there's been really an explosion in this number of measures. And this is already having an impact on global trade. We are not deglobalizing. We're not seeing trade as a share of GDP collapsing. But we see a lot of reconfiguration of the global trade linkages as a result of these trade frictions. And this reconfiguration is costly. It could have efficiency costs. It could weigh down on economic activity. And we could have even more of this coming down the pike. And that's certainly something that we are very concerned about.
Hmm. And finally, you know, with the spring meetings behind you, can you talk to us a little about the process of putting this report together? I mean, what stood out for you personally? And what do you think the report is telling us about where we're headed?
Well, so on the process, I mean, the World Economic Outlook, the first chapter, which is the one where we present our projections for the next 5 years, mm-hmm. Is really a collective effort. I mean, it's something that is prepared and is owned by the research department in terms of presenting this report. But the projections themselves are coming from all the desks of all the countries that we follow. And I like to describe it as a bottom-up approach means the top-down. So what the research department does is we're a little bit like the conductor of the orchestra. We provide the beat, we provide a little bit of the tunes. Here are the assumptions that we are working with in terms of what might happen to oil prices, what the Federal Reserve might be doing, what some of the major central banks might be doing. Here are some broad assumptions. And then we have the whole orchestra is playing their tunes. But at the end of the day, everything has to be harmonious and has to be in sync. So there is a sense in which we're also there to make sure that it's what we call multilaterally consistent, so that if you're a country that says, well, I expect a lot of growth because all my neighbors are growing, well, it'd be the case that the neighbors are saying that they're growing as well, because otherwise we'll have a little bit of attention there. So it's an effort that takes all of these projections coming with a lot of expertise, very granular expertise coming from the desks in the area departments that are putting this forecast together, and then making sure that the picture that emerges is consistent. It's self-consistent. And then from there, what we do is we try to understand what's going on. So we sit and when we write our first chapter, it's really to put together all the different threads and understand the drivers behind that global outlook.
Fantastic. It's a real balance of capturing insight from people who have been working in various parts of the world in different departments over the years, and the data, making sure that you're representing what the data is saying. Very interesting. Pierre-Olivier Gorinchat is the economic counselor of the IMF, and may I say, the head conductor, perhaps, of the World Economic Outlook. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Again, that was IMF chief economist Pierre-Olivier Gorinchat, talking about the latest World Economic Outlook. Check it out at imf.org. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, what used to be Twitter, @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.